other camp will keep trying to promote this agenda of disarming Hezbollah. And of course, on the other hand, Hezbollah will try to fail their plans. But while doing so, the Americans and their allies in Lebanon will further deteriorate the economic situation as to blame Hezbollah.
Newcomers to the parliament include members of civil society, which are reportedly sponsored by the United States. The Lebanese forces and its allies also secured a relatively large bloc and could step up their anti-resistance rhetoric.
They were sponsored by the United States, and part of the sponsorship is to promote this agenda, which is to call for disarming Hezbollah as a mean to isolate Lebanon from the Arab-Israeli struggle and facilitate the deal of the century to pass.
The new parliament is set to meet within 15 days to elect its executive council and a speaker of the parliament. In the aftermath of the Lebanese parliamentary elections, many fear that the polarization reflected in the campaigns preceding the elections could be manifested in parliament, leading to a political paralysis. Will the foes succeed in putting aside controversial issues and work together towards financial recovery? Or are there foreign interests that require that a war of attrition against the resistance continues? Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school. Two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbass separatists.
The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done.
A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling, and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery.
While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Ukraine for weapons to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these 2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزای لازمی است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله. يَسَّرْنَا الْقُرْآنَ لِلذِّكْرِ فَهَلْ مِن مُّدَّكِرٍ.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, currently we are explaining Surah Ar-Rahman, which is considered the crown of the Noble Quran, since it opens with the word Ar-Rahman, or the All-Beneficent, thus proclaiming one of the most beautiful attributes of the Almighty Creator. This surah highlights the All-Merciful Lord's wonders of creation, describes the end of the material world, and paints an evocative picture of the delights of paradise. Hell is briefly contrasted in Ayah 43 with the joys that await the righteous. The refrain, فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ, which means, so which of your Lord's bounties will you both mankind and jinn deny, runs throughout the surah. We continue from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30 of the said surah.
كُلُّ مَنْ عَلَيْهَا فَانٍ وَيَبْقَى وَجْهُ رَبِّكَ ذُو الْجَلَالِ وَالْإِكْرَامِ فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ. يسأله من في السماوات والأرض كل يوم هو في شأن فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان.
Everyone on it, that is the earth, is ephemeral, yet lasting is the essence of your Lord, majestic and munificent. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? Everyone in the heavens and the earth entreats him every moment he is in a state of glory. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last Friday, we said mankind and jinn are both creatures of this planet, but formed out of different material substances, the former from earth and water, and the latter from fire and wind. Thus, both are accountable for their beliefs and deeds in view of the gifts of the intellect, speech and free will given to them in order to determine reward or punishment. We also refer to the wondrous description of the sky, the celestial bodies, and the nature of the earth, including the seasonal cycle, the differing duration of days and nights, and the varying degrees of heat and cold throughout the year, as well as bodies of sweet and salty waters, all of which enable life to flourish on planet Earth. This orderly functioning of the universe is based on a precise plan determined by the Almighty Creator, who has granted us the power of the brain and the physical strength, which, among other things, enable us to build huge ships and other fascinating means of travel and transportation on land, sea, and in the air. The ayahs that we recited to you now are a reference to the ephemeral or transient nature of the mortal world, despite its wondrous blessings, and only the divine essence of the one and only Creator of the universe is eternal. Thus, we ought to seize the opportunity to do good in order to earn durable rewards in afterlife, rather than lead a life of sin, disbelief, indulgence in material things, and immersion in passing pleasures, all of which entail unending misery and horrible punishment. In other words, this transience, including our short life, ought to make us strive for opening a window of perpetual bliss, or a tunnel and path leading to the immortal abode of everlastingness. Ayah 27 mentions the Arabic word wajh, which literally denotes face or countenance. But since it is applied here to God Almighty, who is far glorious to have any form, shape, or place, it means his pure essence, which is majestic and munificent. Ayah 29 refers to both the verbal or nonverbal expressions of human beings and all other creatures, who always beseech God in their own particular ways for mercy, forgiveness, and removal of disappointment, desperation, neglect, vanity, etc. He, the Almighty, creates something anew every moment in the vast universe according to his wisdom and the perfect order of things. So, how can we deny the bounties and blessings of our merciful Lord? From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one, death and destruction awaits all, and every created thing is perishable. So, we should always strive for good deeds instead of disobeying the Creator. Number two, only the Almighty Creator is immortal, and we should rely on Him alone. And number three, the entire creation manifests divine majesty and munificence and functions in the most orderly manner. Let us now listen to ayahs 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, and 36 of Surah Ar-Rahman.
سَنَفْرُغُ لَكُمْ أَيُّكَ الثَّقَلَانِ فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ يا معشر الجن والإنس إن استطعتم أن تنفذوا من أقطار السماوات والأرض فانفذوا لا تنفذون إلا بسلطان فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان يرسل عليكما شواظ من نار ونحاس فلا تنتصران فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان
We shall soon attend to your records, O you notable two species of creatures. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? O company of jinn and humans, if you can pass through
the zones of the heavens and the earth, then do pass through, but you will not pass through except by an authority from Allah. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? There will be unleashed upon you a flash of fire and smoke. Then you will not be able to help one another. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? Ayah 31 says, attention shall be paid to the records of all blessings for the human beings and the jinn, who are being called the Thaqalan, or two weighty entities, since they possess intellect, speech, free choice, and distinction, and are superior to all other creatures. Thus, these two species are warned against denial of divine bounties. Ayah 33 poses a challenge to the bid of the jinn and the human beings to penetrate the heights of the heavens and the depth of the earth, saying, you will not succeed despite your attempts unless God grants you the power and permission to do so. In continuation, Ayah 35 means to warn the jinn and mankind that if any attempt is made in this regard without cognizance of the laws of Allah governing the universe, the consequence is failure, disaster, and destruction. Even if you help each other when confronted with terrible flashes of fire and then suffocating smoke from which there is no escape. So do not deny the bounties of the Lord Most High. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the powers of the intellect, speech, and free will given by God Almighty require responsibility and accountability for all actions. Hence, all blessings are recorded, and the Lord Most High is aware of even the minutest thing. Number two, the power of the brain and the strength of the body, coupled with science and technology, should not make mankind and jinn think of conquering outer space and the inner depth of the earth unless God grants permission. And number three, neither mankind nor the jinn have any immunity against fire, which, if unleashed upon them by angels, will destroy them. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 37, 38, 39, and 40 of the same surah.
فَإِذَا انشَقَّتِ السَّمَاءُ فَكَانَتْ وَرْدَةً كَالدِّهَانِ فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ فَيَوْمَئِذٍ لَا يُسْأَلُ عَنْ ذَنْبِهِ إِنْسٌ وَلَا جَانٌ فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ.
When the sky is split open and turns crimson like tanned leather, so which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? On that day, no question shall be asked of mankind or jinn as to their sins. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? These ayahs refer to the prelude to the day of resurrection, saying, the present system governing the earth and the sky shall collapse. Horrendous events will take place as celestial bodies and whole galaxies will veer from their orbits, turning into a flood of molten substances beyond our imagination, before emergence of a new order of existence. Human beings and jinn will be resurrected and pass through different stations, depending upon their deeds. At some stations, they will not be questioned about their sins, since they will have no power to speak, and every part of their body will testify in the divine court to misuse of the respective organs. Thus, as the record of every individual is quite clear and speaks of itself, nothing can be denied. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the system on the day of resurrection will emerge after great upheavals. Number two, committing of sins is tantamount to denial of God's bounties. And number three, the jinn, like mankind, are prone to commit sins, and the record of their deeds will be crystal clear, even if they are not questioned at certain stations. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 41, 42, 43, 44, and 45 of Surah Ar-Rahman.
يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان هذه جهنم التي يكذب بها المجرمون يطوفون بينها وبين حميم آن فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان
The guilty will be recognized by their mark, so they will be seized by the forelocks and the feet. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? This is the hell which the guilty would deny. They will circuit between it and boiling hot water. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? On the day of judgment, the faces of the guilty will reflect their deeds. Those who had committed all kinds of sins and disobeyed divine command by all their beings, from their hair to their feet, shall be seized by their hair and feet to be cast into hellfire, since they died in the state of disbelief or did not repent of their sins. In contrast to the smiling and brilliant faces of the virtuous, reflecting their faith and good deeds, the faces of disbelievers and unrepentant sinners shall be dark, ugly, and sullen, reflecting their faithlessness and evil deeds. Ayah 42, which is a warning to mankind and the jinn, repeats the rhetorical question, So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? Ayahs 43 and 44 depict the terrible fate of the people of hell. The disbelievers and unrepentant sinners will be told by the angels that this is a hell of which the prophets had warned you, but you denied and belied it out of arrogance, vanity, enmity, and ignorance. Those cast into hell will move between the blazing fire and boiling water. Ayah 45 is again a serious warning against denial of divine bounties that leads to hell. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, those who deny the day of resurrection as well as paradise and hell will be thrown in a humiliating manner into the eternal inferno. And number two, committing of sins and denial of the day of resurrection are two sides of the same coin. That is, one sets the ground for the other.
The Spotlight.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The white gunman has killed 10 people and wounded 3 others. 11 other people who were shot were black. The gunman was an 18-year-old who wrote a white supremacist manifesto online. What can bring about hate in a white person so much to drive 200 miles to a black neighborhood and kill 10 people? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what police have described as a hate crime and why white-black tensions remain at a critically high level in the United States, including a review of other hate crimes that occur in that country. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, Gerald Horn, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe, who joins us from Detroit. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So we're looking at an unprecedented incident that has taken place. It's really sad to see things like this happen time and again. Gerald Horn, let me first start with you. This has been categorized as a hate crime, and in my intro, I'm going to relay that question to you, of which, how much hate can a white person have for blacks, and in this case, to have so much hate to build up to commit such a horrific crime, driving 200 miles, and then kill 10 people as a result, and that could have been more.
We have a very seriously profound problem in the United States of America. And I think it's important for your audience to recognize that on the one hand, this is an elite phenomenon. That is to say, if you were able to tune into Fox News, one of the major cable networks in the United States today, which also has interests in Australia and in Britain, and in fact in India as well, you would hear the kind of rhetoric, the kind of language that helped to drive this sick, demented individual to slaughter all of these people in Buffalo. But at the same time, it's a mass phenomenon. In a few days, I'll have a book coming out on 19th century Texas where I point out that if you look at the liquidation of what we call the Indian population, the indigenous population of North America, it not only came from mandates from the top, it came from actions by poor European settlers who wanted to seize the land of the Indians. And likewise, you have a number of white American working class and middle class people today who are rather easily manipulated by this point that supposedly the reason they're not doing very well in the economic marketplace is not because of the elites bringing down $14 million, $15 million salaries on an annual basis, but because of the fact that black people are stealing their jobs, that Mexican Americans are stealing their jobs, that immigrants are stealing their jobs. Because we have both an elite problem and a mass problem, it makes it even more difficult to solve.
Well, looking at what was described as one of the things that this white male had in terms of, or is in terms of his character makeup, Abayomi Azikiwe, is that he was called a white supremacist. So naturally, looking at the definition,
which you can tell us what that is exactly. But then looking deeper into this, came across a terminology that it was called replacement theory from one outlet, and then it seems like the more prevalent term is called white genocide. I'd like for you to put that into context for us, the difference there, because white genocide, white supremacist falls under that, if I'm correct to understand it. Perhaps you can tell us, Abiyomi Azikiwe.
Well, thank you. The white supremacist ideology is deeply rooted in United States history, its institutions. This was founded as a white supremacist state going all the way back to the British colonies, the Dutch colonies in the Northeast. So this is nothing new. These mass executions, lynchings have been carried out from the period of enslavement all the way through the post-Reconstruction period, all the way into the 20th century. If we look just over the last several years, Dylann Roof walked into a historic African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, and killed a number of black people based upon the same delusional, racist, ideological issues. So this is continuing inside the United States. Racist, whether...
I'm going to get back to you, Abiyomi. Let me get to Gerald Horn with this question about what is white supremacist and what is this white genocide, which is something that this particular person it was known to follow, which includes a whole variety of things, which basically is about how white replacement is being thrown about. It calls it many call it a conspiracy theory, but this particular person and many others like him believe in that. Can you please tell us what white genocide is?
Well, this fallacy of white genocide is the idea that there is some sort of plot to reduce or replace the population that is defined as white by Mexican immigrants, by Haitian immigrants, by African immigrants. The problem is that from the inception of this settler state and the settler colonies going back to the 1500s, about 500 years ago, this has been a territory that has been populated not only by people of European descent, but by people of non-European descent. The difference was that historically, the people of non-European descent were treated in a third-class or fourth-class manner. But the issue is that over the centuries, we've been able to organize, and now we are only treated in a second-class manner. And many of those who are defined as white object to that. They think we should be treated in a fourth-class manner. And that leads to this idea of white genocide, the fact that they're not able to treat us as if we were in apartheid South Africa in 1949. And likewise, this idea that they are not able to prevail. They're not able to necessarily get every job that they want in competition with black people, for example. And of course, they consider the ultimate insult to be that black men oftentimes date or even marry women that are defined as white. And that is the nub of the question.
Taking a look at the stats that are out there, it's alarming that you have hate crimes that have increased, and it's at a 10-year high. I looked at the stats from the year 2019 to 2021, Abiyomi, and it states that there were roughly a little over 7,300 hate crimes, up from 7,100, and the highest number recorded since the year 2008. Now, when you talk about hate crime, obviously blacks are targeted. It's the highest category. So the first question is, why are blacks targeted? Which then brings about the question about hate crimes, not just involving African Americans, but then you go into Asians, for example. They have now turned up to be somewhat at the top. And then, of course, you have Latinos in there. And then we can go, of course, into categories like Muslims and Jews. So what's going on? First, why are blacks at the top of the list here?
Well, if you look at the history of the United States, the ruling class in this country was largely built as a result of the expropriation of African labor during enslavement. And even during the post-enslavement period, there's still the super exploitation of African labor. We also see it in those communities that are of Latin American descent, Asian American descent, and hate crimes are escalating against all people of color communities. In part, it has to do with, as well, the changing demographics of the United States, the fact that people of color communities are growing in regard to their proportion of the overall U.S. population. And many of these people tend to vote non-Republican, they tend to vote Democratic, but the Democratic Party does not have a program that can encompass their needs based upon their social status. So eventually, these people of color communities and other communities in the United States will break with the Democratic Party. And of course, when that happens, there is the propensity for even greater racial conflict in the United States. We saw in 2021 with the attempted right-wing coup at the aegis of former President Donald Trump. And there's a whole movement out there that is really an extension of the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist organizations that arose during the post-Civil War period. And these were rich, wealthy whites that formed the Ku Klux Klan. People like Nathan Bedford Forrest, who made a fortune as a slave trader. He was a general in the Confederate Army, and he was one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan. So these policies come directly from the ruling elites here in the United States. So, and they're going to continue, and unfortunately, they're going to worsen in the years to come.
It's interesting, Gerald Horn, that our guest there says that, the fact that it's going to worsen, because I just talked about some demographics. So then what's left really are the whites, aside from the ones that I mentioned. But then even within the whites, there are there are frictions. For example, in Boston, if you go to the Harvard area, as opposed to the people who are over the river, there's clashes there in terms of just culture not mixing. And I'm talking whites within whites. So what's the big picture in the U.S.? I mean, multiculturalism obviously has failed, and yet it's gotten to a boiling point and crisis mode, as we see incidents like this happen where you have this white person come out and kill 10 African Americans.
Well, you have to realize that for decades now, the U.S. ruling elite has fought a very bitter struggle against the very idea of class solidarity. That is to say, working class people who are the majority and come from various ethnic and racial backgrounds uniting in order to get higher wages and better working conditions. Because of this war against working class solidarity, you've had the proliferation, I'm afraid to say, particularly in the population that's defined as white, of a certain kind of racial and ethnic chauvinism. Indeed, it's not accidental, I'm afraid to say, that this massacre took place in Buffalo. Just a few months ago, you had a Democrat who also defined herself as a socialist, who was on the verge of being elected mayor of Buffalo, but the elites in the Democratic Party were afraid that her policies would lead to a redistribution of wealth from the top to the bottom, and they schemed to derail her candidacy and to make sure that she was. Likewise, if you look at the U.S. president, Joseph R. Biden, who cares about this racist massacre, recall that in the early 1970s, he got his start as a politician by campaigning and crusading against the very idea that there should be school desegregation by using buses. Supposedly, he was against the bus, but as Reverend Jesse Jackson, a leader in this country, might have said at that time, he was actually against us. That is to say, he was whipping up hysteria amongst the so-called white majority in order to deflect attention away from the fact that those at the top of the socioeconomic pyramid, speaking of the 1% of the society, are making out like bandits at the expense of the white working class, and in fact, at the expense of the entire working class.
Sure. Well, it's very interesting how blacks are being targeted, or African Americans, I should say, Abiyomi Ezekiwe, because the analysis drawn from that from some is the fact that the white, and I'm talking very generally, so pardon me for putting it this way, but I have a reason for that, because some are saying and deducting or analyzing, saying that You know, the whites want to hold supremacy. I say that, and I want to put this next to this particular stat, which came out in the year 2019, that the cost of racism in the U.S. economy is costing the U.S. economy $16 trillion. 16. One figure from another source has put it at $50 trillion because of discrimination. And African-Americans is part of that, including Latinos and people of color. If the U.S. government acknowledges this, which Biden did during his run as a president, when he was running for presidency, why isn't it doing anything about it? Why is it still continuing, then, the issue of racism to the degree that it is, costing the government so much money?
Well, costing the government money is contingent upon what type of society we have in the United States. Racism, the super exploitation of labor of African people and other people of color communities is very profitable to the ruling interests in the United States. Disrupting that system would better the living conditions for the majority of people inside the United States. There's this divide, of course, between those who seek to bring about a broader democratic dispensation and those who want to narrow the dispensation to only include white males. And we see this in many different political debates taking place inside the United States. At this time, the U.S. is undergoing a very turbulent economic period with hyperinflation that we haven't seen in the last 40 years. And this is going to have a disproportionate impact on African Americans and people from the Latino community, as well as working class whites. So interjecting these hate messages in the white community to make it appear as if black people and brown people and indigenous people and Asian people, Muslims, women are taking away something that should be by right belonging to white men is a very dangerous ideology. And I don't think the growing people of color community inside the United States is going to tolerate this in the long term. African Americans have struck back against racist violence, and they will continue to do so. And it remains to be seen if these whites who are attempting to move the United States that far to the right will be successful. It's really open to question whether they will be or not, because in doing that, they're going to have to move against a great number of their own people.
Okay, so are we at that point, Gerald Horn, or have we passed it where we're going to see some kind of uprising? We see the protests happening when you have police brutality cases that involve, for example, a white police officer and how he has killed an African-American. We've seen that incident a number of times. But has it reached the crisis point where the uprising is going to be in large numbers and masses in the U.S.?
Well, that's one option. That is to say, a mass uprising that will beat back thoroughly and decisively the racists. Another option, I'm afraid to say, is the option of U.S. fascism. I would dare say that there are the seeds of fascism in the United States as we speak, based upon the point, as already has been mentioned, that the United States was built as a settler society involving liquidation of the Native Americans and expropriation of the labor of the Africans. However, I will also say that just as this racist terrorist in Buffalo received aid and comfort from abroad, the idea of replacement theory that he was spouting actually is an import from France that has been adapted in the United States. I think also that the fascists can be defeated, the terrorists can be defeated with international solidarity. Because keep in mind that if these fascists actually gain more power in the United States today than they wield at this particular moment, it will not only be people of color and black people in particular who are treated atrociously, this will inevitably be exported. That has been the lesson of US, the United States. That is to say, the problems in the United States do not necessarily stay inside of the United States. Inevitably, they're exported abroad, which is one of the reasons of why I would make an urgent and passionate call to our friends in Iran to rally to our defense, because this would not only be an act of charity on your part towards people struggling against dehumanization in the United States of America, it would be in your own self-interest as well.
Sure. It's interesting you use the terminology, dehumanization. But what was also very interesting, which I think is going to be the last question here, Abiyomi Azikiwe, is one of the things that this 18-year-old mentioned that he got his idea for doing and executing what he did was from the Brenton Harrison Tarrant case in Australia, in which you had him, you know, doing that live streaming and killing 51 people. And of course, this was in a mosque and Muslims were targeted. I mentioned before that there are Jewish people that fall on those, under this white supremacy, which some call conspiracy, of which they're saying that, you know, what, there's a plan that whites are being eliminated. Are there going to be, is there a social crisis that the U.S. is engulfed in where you have different demographics that may be, you know, fighting each other when you see cases like what we just, what we have witnessed with the killing of these 10 people, African-Americans?
Oh, most definitely. All you have to do is live in a U.S. city, whether it is a majority African-American, I live in Detroit, or in other cities like New York City, Los Angeles, Seattle, and you can see the growing class divisions. You can see the racial polarization that is taking place. And unfortunately, neither of the two dominant political parties inside the United States has any program to address these issues.
They are being allowed to fester. They do or they don't.
Yeah, they're allowing these problems to continue to escalate. And as long as they escalate, it's going to worsen the capacity of the United States to act in any type of unified fashion. And it's just going to worsen the overall social conditions inside the United States.
Okay.
And
I can give Gerald Horn, I can give Gerald Horn 30 seconds there. Gerald Horn, so you said that Iran could help, but let's put the context domestically. In your capacity, what can you do, and what would you advise others in order to stop this crisis that the U.S. is experiencing between different classes?
Well, the elephant in the room is the proliferation of weapons. It was quite simple and easy for this terrorist to buy a weapon, even though he explicitly said that it could be used to kill human beings. Unfortunately, there is a logjam in Congress with regard to circumscribing the sale of weapons. If you don't want to circumscribe the sale of weapons, of course, you could circumscribe the sale of bullets. But unfortunately, there's no political will for either.
Thank you very much for that, Gerald Horn there, professor of African-American Studies at the University of Houston. Thank you for your thoughts. And editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abiyomi Azikiwe from Detroit. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikava Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next